Imagine just throwing heavily pigmented water onto this thick cotton paper. You basically have zero control.
Yeah, totally at the mercy of the water.
Right, there's no undo button. It is this chaotic, highly stressful physical process. And yet, out of all that violent physics, the artist we're looking at today managed to pull off this portrait of absolute serene spiritual liberation.
It really is a massive contradiction when you think about it.
It is. So welcome to today's deep dive.
Ah.
Our mission today is to discover exactly how the raw, unpredictable mechanics of painting, I mean, heavy water washes, granulated pigments, thick cotton fibers, how all of that can capture and communicate this immense life philosophy.
And the piece we are looking at to explore this is a watercolor titled Quattro, Maestro Spiritual. It was painted by Jairo Duque, part of his larger series, Trasteo Pintura Artistica.
And the subject looking back at you from the frame is A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
Right, the historical founder of the ISKCON movement. Most people probably know it as the Hare Krishna movement.
Yeah, exactly. But what makes the source material we have today so incredibly valuable is that, we aren't just analyzing some finished painting hanging on a sterile gallery wall. We actually have access to the artist's personal technical notes.
Which is so rare.
It is. We get this step-by-step window into his creative decisions, his material choices, and, well, his whole overarching process.
Which really turns today into a masterclass in synthesis. I mean, we're bridging this gap between working with a highly stressful, totally fluid medium like watercolor, and then the delivery of a message that's focused entirely on liberation and spiritual calm.
The everyday decisions he's making at the easel are just deeply connected to the monumental message, the final portrait
Yeah,
project.
exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this because before we can even talk about the mechanics of how this was physically painted, we have to establish what is actually happening in the frame itself.
Right, the visual impact.
Yeah, because when we think of traditional depictions of spiritual enlightenment in art, we usually picture, I don't know, profound distance.
Oh, absolutely.
We imagine looking way up at this towering marble statue, or maybe a figure in a Renaissance painting wrapped in this stoic expression.
Right, surrounded by unreachable auras and glowing halos.
Exactly.
Untouchable. Historians actually refer to those as hieratic images. They're these rigid, very frontal, highly tense depictions. The subject's eyes are usually just lost in the infinite, gazing entirely past the
Think
viewer.
you're not even there.
Yeah, they project divine authority, and they are specifically designed to inspire reverence, to make you feel small, essentially.
But this portrait just shatters every single one of those expectations. If you are picturing a man levitating in the middle of some solemn rite, you are way off.
Completely off.
Prabhupada is just sitting down, and he's wearing this very informal, everyday gray turtleneck sweater.
Which is such a great detail.
Right, and he has a simple pink cloth draped over his lap. He's holding a glass of water in a way that feels, I don't know, almost careless. And he's looking forward with this immense, luminous, deeply human smile.
He looks like he's just enjoying a casual mid-afternoon break in a kitchen somewhere. The artist is intentionally avoiding all those conventional tropes of religious majesty.
Now, Duke actually wrote in his notes that he did not want a conventional portrait. He wanted what he called a territory of consciousness.
A beautiful phrase.
It is, but I want to push back on this approach a little bit, or at least just play the skeptic for a second.
Okay, go for it.
Why would stripping away all that divine majesty, the traditional halos and the levitation, why is that actually a more effective way to project spiritual mastery to a modern observer? Doesn't the informality run the risk of making a revered guru seem, well, just too ordinary?
What's fascinating here is that the artist recognizes a fundamental truth about human psychology and really the barrier that traditional art creates. When a hieratic image projects that rigid divine authority we talked about, it inherently builds a massive wall.
Like a literal barrier between you and the subject.
Exactly. The artwork looks down at you and essentially says, "I am up here and you are down there." It demands submission from you rather than a genuine connection.
Right, it makes the spiritual state feel completely unattainable for the normal person standing in the gallery.
But true spiritual mastery, at least according to the philosophy, this specific work is communicating it doesn't require distance at all. It actually requires profound presence and extreme approachability.
Wow.
By removing that heavy armor of divine majesty, the artist is making a really radical statement. He's saying enlightenment isn't about being untouchable, it's about inhabiting the human experience with total lightness and a welcoming spirit.
Wow. and we can actually see that conceptual lightness mirrored in the physical environment where the watercolor was created. The setting of the creation ends up being just as important as the subject himself.
Oh, the studio space, yes.
Yeah, looking at Duke's technical notes, he specifies that this piece was painted in December 2022, but he didn't paint it in some grand, echoing European academy or a silent monastery on a hill.
Not at all.
He painted it in his small, everyday residential home studio in Whittier, California.
And that geographical and environmental context, it just provides such a vital contrast. Think about it. This portrait of a major spiritual leader is being forged in a regular, everyday neighborhood.
Right, with traffic outside.
Yeah. The environment involves the artist's daily routines, the hum of that traffic, the mundane reality of running a home studio, organizing supplies, just dealing with everyday distractions.
It totally encapsulates the ISK Con philosophy. Deep spirituality, what they refer to as Krishna consciousness,
yeah.
It doesn't demand that you flee the material world.
You don't have to escape.
Right. You don't have to pack your bags, abandon your responsibilities, and go isolate yourself in a remote mountain cave just to achieve peace. That spiritual state can manifest right there in a neighborhood studio in Whittier.
Or in a kitchen.
Exactly. It manifests in the mundane moments, like sharing a laugh or taking a sip from a glass of water.
And this ties directly into a core Vedic principle that really acts as the foundation for this whole discussion. It's the concept that we are not this body.
Right, that's a huge part of the philosophy.
According to the Vedic texts, we are spiritual sparks. We are eternal consciousness, and we're currently just passing through a very temporary, highly vulnerable material experience. Our bodies, our environments, our physical struggles, they're just temporary vehicles.
And because the material world is temporary, there is no need to take its heavy burden so incredibly seriously. You can live your day-to-day routine with a sense of joy, coherence, and just a light touch.
Yeah, you can wear a gray turtleneck and simply exist in the present moment.
The spiritual mastery is demonstrated in how gracefully you handle that temporary vehicle of your life, not in pretending the vehicle doesn't exist at all.
Exactly. You engage with the material world, but you remain totally untethered by its anxieties.
Which, honestly, brings us to the most incredible contradiction in this whole analysis, because it is very easy for us to sit here with microphones and talk about a philosophy of lightness and serene joy in the abstract.
Oh, sure. On paper, it sounds lovely.
Right. But executing that physical lightness using the medium of watercolor, that is a massive, stressful undertaking. For anyone listening who has ever actually picked up a watercolor brush, you know this medium is entirely unforgiving.
It is the absolute definition of high stakes. The medium actively fights your control at every step.
There is no undo button. You make one mistake with your water-to-pigment ratio, and the paper just turns into a warped, muddy disaster. The artist had to solve this philosophical demand for lightness through pure mechanical engineering at the easel.
And that engineering, it begins at the literal foundation of the piece, the paper. The paper is the stage where this entire physical drama unfolds.
Let's talk about that paper, because the specs Duke leaves in his notes are highly unusual for a portrait like this. He chose to use Arch's cold-pressed, rough-grain paper, but the sheer weight of it is what really caught my eye. It is 640 grams per square meter.
That is exceptionally heavy duty. I mean, a standard good quality watercolor paper usually sits around, what, 300 grams?
Yeah, exactly. So he more than doubled the structural weight of his surface. And if you think about it mechanically, water is the natural enemy of paper.
Right, it destroys it.
When you apply heavy washes of water to standard paper, it buckles. The surface warps into these hills and valleys, the fibers expand and break apart, and the pigment just pools uncontrollably. I like to think of this 640-gram paper like putting a high-end off-road suspension on a vehicle.
Oh, that analogy captures the mechanics perfectly. You need a structure capable of absorbing the trauma of the process.
Yeah. If you are driving over incredibly rocky, volatile terrain, which in this case is the massive amounts of water and wet pigment the artist is throwing down, you need a suspension system that can take a severe beating.
A heavy beating, yeah.
The heavy paper acts as an industrial shock absorber. It handles all the intense physical stress, all the tension of the water, so that the final image of the guru looks effortlessly fluid.
Right. It hides the struggle.
It gives this beautiful, vibrant life to the gray turtleneck and the pink cloth, while entirely hiding the violent physical reactions happening within the cotton fibers underneath.
The paper absorbs the chaos so the image doesn't have to. But, you know, an off-road suspension still requires the right fuel to perform.
Oh, the paint.
Right. The second major technical choice detailed in his notes is his pigment selection. He specifies the use of Daniel Smith watercolors, and he chose them for their unique chemical properties.
So there is a deep mechanical reason for that specific choice, well beyond just a brand preference.
Oh, absolutely. These particular pigments are famous for two distinct behaviors: extreme transparency and heavy granulation.
Okay, let's break that down.
Well, if your goal is to paint a portrait that communicates a vibrating, living spirituality, you cannot afford to use opaque colors. Opaque paints, like gouache or acrylic, they act like a solid wall.
They just sit there.
Right. They sit on top of the paper and physically block light from penetrating the surface.
So you just end up with a flat, muddy block on the canvas.
Exactly. But transparent watercolors operate entirely differently. When you lay down a transparent wash, it behaves almost like stained glass. The ambient light in the room physically passes through the microscopic layer of paint, hits the thick white cotton fibers of that 640-gram paper beneath it, and bounces back outward into the viewer's eye.
Wow. So it creates a literal optical vibration.
The painting physically breathes light. And then when you combine that transparency with granulation, the effect is totally magnified.
Because granulating pigments have texture.
Right. They contain heavier mineral particles.
Yeah.
As the water evaporates on that rough grain paper, those heavy particles fall out of suspension. They settle into the microscopic valleys of the paper's texture.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It creates this organic, mottled texture that feels incredibly alive and grounded. It really echoes the philosophy of finding spirituality in the tactile physical world.
But wait, this actually brings up a terrifying technical risk that I noticed in the notes. I need to play devil's advocate again.
Yeah.
Because there is a glaring contradiction in his process that kind of threatens to ruin all this beautiful vibrating transparency we just broke down.
Okay, let's explore that contradiction.
So Duke states that he wants a breathed, loose atmosphere. He is chasing lightness. But when he describes his process for painting Prabhupada's face, which is the absolute focal point of the entire artwork, he admits he built it using progressive layers.
Oh, yeah. That is tricky.
Anyone who paints knows that layering in watercolor is basically walking a tightrope over a mud pit.
It really is.
Watercolor is a subtractive medium. Every single layer you add darkens the image and increases the risk of destroying the transparency. If you re-wet a previous layer, you risk lifting the pigment and turning the whole thing into an opaque disaster.
You lose the light entirely.
Right. And suddenly, your enlightened guru looks like he is wearing a thick, heavy plastic mask. So how on earth did he layer the focal point of the painting without destroying its freshness?
It represents the ultimate tension of the medium, for sure. Navigating that risk is just a masterclass in visual storytelling and restraint. He avoided creating that muddy plastic mask by adhering strictly to his own guiding artistic rule.
Whose was?
Well, in the margins of his notes, he writes a crucial maxim. He says, privilege tonal vibration over excessive detail.
Privilege tonal vibration over excessive detail. Oh. Okay, so how does that philosophy actually translate to the physical movement of the brush?
It requires supreme discipline. When he applies those layers, he has to actively resist the urge to paint every microscopic pore on the guru's nose or every single individual eyelash.
Which is so tempting when you're doing a portrait.
So tempting. Instead, he uses broad, highly transparent washes to build the underlying geometry of the face. He's establishing the large foundational shapes of light and shadow. But the true magic happens because he forces himself to stop before the accumulating details choke the life out of the painting.
He steps back.
He places immense trust in the viewer. He understands that the human eye and the visual processing centers of the brain are incredibly efficient at filling in incomplete information.
Right. The brain naturally wants to complete the puzzle.
Exactly. There is actually this really poignant analogy from the source material that illustrates this perfectly. Consider hyperrealism.
Okay.
Painting in a hyper-realistic style is like taking a dead butterfly and pinning it to a corkboard.
Oh, wow.
I mean, you can use a magnifying glass to examine every single scale on its wing, right? You achieve absolute clinical scientific precision, but you sacrifice the actual life and movement of the creature to get it.
You kill it to understand it.
Yeah. Duke's approach, prioritizing that tonal vibration over minute detail, it's like catching a live butterfly in your hands for just a split second. You don't get the opportunity to count every scale on the wing. It's moving, it's fluttering, the edges are slightly blurred, but you experience the genuine life, the energy, and the vibration of the creature.
That is just brilliant. You catch the life of the creature without killing it with precision. So, what does this all mean when we look at the rest of the canvas? I mean, how does this less is more philosophy apply to the space surrounding the guru?
The philosophy of restraint takes over the canvas entirely when you look at the background. It is where the artist's discipline is arguably most apparent.
Let's paint the picture of that background for the listener. Because if you look behind the figure of Prabhupada, you won't find intricate temples.
No architecture.
No bustling city streets, no ornate furniture, no intricate tapestries. It consists purely of a series of very loose, abstract, almost formless strokes of green, brown, and yellow watercolor.
Just washes of color.
And in his notes, Dupe refers to this specific area with a beautiful, evocative phrase. He calls it a space of silence.
Describing negative space as a space of silence completely shifts how we understand the composition. Think about the acoustic design of a world-class concert hall.
Okay, acoustics.
Silence in that architectural context isn't just an empty void where nothing is happening. Silence is the structural foundation that allows the music to exist in the first place.
Without the deliberate design of that silence, you'd just end up with a wall of chaotic noise.
Exactly. If the concert hall is filled with echoing chatter, structural vibrations, or competing sounds, the main note, the pure melody, is completely lost in the mud. By painting this abstract space of silence, the artist creates the perfect visual acoustics.
That's a great way to put it. Visual acoustics.
The silence exists solely to allow the main note, which in this painting is the guru's immense joyful smile and his approachable spiritual presence. It allows that note to resonate loudly, cleanly, and clearly in the viewer's mind.
But creating that level of silence requires the artist to willingly step back and surrender control. And this leads to a moment in the technical notes that I found just incredibly striking.
The self-critique.
Yes.
Yeah.
Duke actually writes a critique of his own finished work. He notes that some of the transitions between the guru's figure and the abstract background could actually be more organic. He points out his own perceived flaw in a painting that has traveled internationally.
Which takes guts.
It really does.
Yeah.
He then concludes with the realization that suggestion is usually more powerful than precision. Reading that, I immediately thought about the artist's ego. I mean, he's actively admitting his flaws. It feels like a profound exercise in humility.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this moment of vulnerability is actually the ultimate embodiment of the ISKCon philosophy we've been tracking through the artwork. The artist, sitting in his residential studio in Whittier, is actively shedding his own ego. By publicly showing intellectual humility, by acting as the eternal student who is always willing to learn from the unpredictable medium of watercolor, he completely sheds the arrogance of the perfect creator.
It parallels the subject of the painting perfectly.
It does. The artist sheds the solemnity and the expectation of perfection as a creator in the exact same way that the portrait sheds the solemnity and the inaccessibility of the traditional hieratic guru. Both the artist working in California and the spiritual master depicted on the paper are fully embracing their humanity.
Their approachability?
Yes, and their inherent imperfections.
The medium, the message, and the creator all align seamlessly. Let's take a step back and just look at the journey we've been on during this deep dive.
It's been a ride.
We started with the extreme physical and mechanical requirements of watercolor, utilizing heavy 640-gram cotton paper to act as industrial shock absorbers against the trauma of water. We watched how the mechanics of granulating transparent pigments allowed light to physically breathe through the portrait. And we followed that physical struggle at the easel, all the way to a profound Vedic philosophy of joyful, everyday spirituality that doesn't demand isolation from the world.
The unforgiving, fluid nature of watercolor literally forced the artist to give up total control. He had to build the geometry, step back, and let the water and pigment do what they naturally do without overworking the details into a muddy mask.
Which serves as a gorgeous, tangible metaphor for accepting our own lack of control in life. We don't have to be flawlessly detailed. We just have to be present and let the light through.
And that leaves us with a fascinating concept to consider as we wrap up our analysis today. Earlier, we discussed the Vedic philosophy that we are not this body. The idea that our physical form is just a temporary, vulnerable vehicle for our consciousness navigating the material world.
Right.
In many ways, our daily lives are exactly like that heavy sheet of rough gray and watercolor paper. We take on water, we face immense stress, we buckle under pressure, and there are absolute undeniable marks made on us by our experiences.
Just like watercolor, life has no C3LZ. We can't hit undo.
We can't. The question I want to leave you with is this. How often do you fight the medium of your own life? If watercolor teaches us that there is no undo button and that frantically scrubbing at a mistake only tears the paper, ruins the foundation, and kills the light, where in your life are you desperately trying to erase a flaw that actually just needs to be accepted? What if, instead of intensely scrubbing at it to achieve some illusion of perfection, that perceived mistake just needs to be integrated, softened, and washed over with a broader, more transparent wash of grace?
That is a beautiful, grounded place to leave it. We hope this deep dive gave you a new lens to view not just technical watercolor portraiture, but the way you handle the unpredictable, beautifully imperfect medium of your own day-to-day life. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening. Keep finding the joy in the everyday.